using rhetoric, demonizing ICE and demonizing CBP. Stop.
A shooter opens fire on an ICE facility in Dallas.
We'll have the latest on the investigation this Wednesday, September 24th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addresses the United Nations General Assembly.
He places responsibility for ending the war on world leaders.
Whether you help peace or continue trading with Russia and helping Russia to fund this war, it depends on you.
Also, the Trump administration has paused regulations that would have forced the steel industry to curb air pollution.
You take a deep breath in Glassport, and you smell hydrogen sulfide, you smell sulfur dioxide.
And one of the first mechanical calculators in history is now up for auction.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. This morning, a shooter opened fire on a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facility in Dallas, Texas. The Department of Homeland Security says at least one detainee was killed. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
Officials say the shooter opened fire from a nearby rooftop. The attacker then killed himself. Investigators say an anti-ICE message was found on the ammunition on the scene. On his X account, FBI Director Kash Patel posted an image of the rounds belonging to the attacker, one of which contained the message, anti-ICE. It's the second attack on an ICE detention facility this year. In July, a police officer was shot outside a facility in Alvarado, Texas. At a press conference this morning, officials disparaged politically motivated violence. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, called for an end to rhetoric against federal immigration agents. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
The government will shut down in 1 week if lawmakers don't come up with a funding plan. President Trump canceled a meeting with congressional Democrats, calling their demands unserious. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Democrats want to boost funding for health care and are willing to negotiate with Republicans to avoid a shutdown.
We will partner in a bipartisan way to try to find common ground in order to enact a spending bill that actually meets the needs of the American people.
Democrats are proposing rolling back Medicaid changes in President Trump's signature tax bill and extending tax credits for Obamacare health plans. Republicans say reversing Medicaid changes is a non-starter. The Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba is making a big push into artificial intelligence. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that news is getting a positive review from investors.
Stock in Alibaba jumped sharply after the e-commerce company announced a new partnership with AI chipmaker NVIDIA. Alibaba says it plans to boost its spending on artificial intelligence to more than $50 billion as it expands data center operations in multiple countries around the world. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell says he and his colleagues will move cautiously on any additional cuts to interest rates. The central bank cut its benchmark rate last week for the first time all year. Powell told a business group in Rhode Island the Fed is trying to guard against a softening job market while also battling stubborn inflation. We'll get an update on inflation from the Commerce Department later this week. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The world's largest carbon polluter, China, says it will cut carbon emissions by 7 to 10% by 2035. The announcement came as more than 100 world leaders gathered to talk about increased urgency and the need for stronger efforts to curb heat-trapping gases. International climate negotiations are set to begin in Brazil in 6.5 weeks. From Washington, this is NPR News. The family of one of the 67 people killed when a commercial plane crashed with an Army helicopter over Washington, D.C. in January is suing the government and the airline involved. The family accuses them of failing to recognize the warning signs after more than 30 documented near misses in the area. Other families are expected to join in the lawsuit against the Federal Aviation Administration, the Army, American Airlines, and its regional partner, PSA Airlines. It was the deadliest U.S. plane crash since 2001. The Christian Girls Camp in Texas, where 27 young girls and counselors died in flooding on July 4th, says it plans to partially reopen next year. The people lost at Camp Mystic were among more than 130 who died during the Texas flood. Texas Public Radio's Marianne Navarro reports.
Camp Mystic said in an email to families it plans to reopen its Cypress Lake campus. Located less than a mile away from the Guadalupe River campus that saw extensive flood damage. Officials at the 99-year-old camp say Mystic will implement changes required in a new state law that regulates camp activity in floodplains and requires more flood response training for staff. Camp officials also say they're working to build a Heavens 27 memorial to honor the girls who died. I'm Maria Navarro in San Antonio.
A bull moose that fell into an abandoned well in Maine was pulled to safety during an elaborate five-hour rescue. State game wardens sedated the moose, put straps around it, and used an excavator to carefully lift it out of a nine-foot-deep well. The family that owns the land says they didn't know the well existed. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. Good afternoon, I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 4:06. Programming is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More information on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Department of Homeland Security says a gunman fired on a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Dallas early today, shooting three detainees. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran is in Dallas now and has the latest on this deadly incident. Hi, Sergio.
Good afternoon, Elsa.
Good afternoon. Okay, so what do we know about the victim so far?
Well, this is still developing news, and the information provided by authorities have been changing. Now, the three victims are detainees, like you mentioned. At least one was killed. According to the Department of Homeland Security, the shooter fired indiscriminately at the ICE facility from a nearby rooftop. He also shot at a van in the security entryway, which is where all of the victims were shot. I talked to Mayra, who is a Nicaraguan immigrant who was inside the building to do her immigration check-in this morning.
Estaba dentro cuando como a las 6:20 comencé a escuchar los detonazos de armas.
She says she was inside the building at around 6:20 a.m. local time when she started hearing gunshots. She says she heard about 20 shots. Now, Mayra requested NPR not use her last name because of her pending immigration case, but she says she froze. She remembers the light blue chairs around her. And the only thing she could think about while the shooting was happening was about her daughter, who was waiting for her outside. Now, eventually, police arrived and evacuated people inside the building.
And what's known so far about the shooter and why an ICE facility was targeted?
Yeah, you know, authorities have not released information about the shooter yet. The gunman was found dead with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Authorities say this shooting is being investigated by the FBI as an act of targeted violence. That is because, according to the FBI, shell casings with, quote, anti-ICE messages were found near the alleged shooter's body. FBI Director Kash Patel released a photo on X earlier today of five rounds that apparently had not been fired. One of them has the words anti-ICE written on it in what seems to be blue ink. And Vice President J.D. Vance said the shooter is a, quote, violent left-wing extremist based on evidence he says the government has, but it's not public yet. Now, earlier today, we also heard from Joshua Johnson, the acting ICE Dallas Field Office Director. Here's what he said.
This is the second time I've had to stand in front of you and talk about a shooter at one of my facilities. And I think that the takeaway from all of this is that the rhetoric has to stop.
The rhetoric has to stop. I mean, Sergio, how much have we seen an increase in attacks on ICE agents recently?
Yeah, you know, Elsa, Johnson is referring to an attack that happened a few months ago over the 4th of July weekend at another ICE facility about 40 miles from Dallas. In that incident, a local police officer was shot in the neck right outside that facility. And the incident was described as an ambush by the U.S. Attorney's Office. At least 10 people were charged in that particular incident. DHS says that this facility in Dallas, where today's shooting happened, was the target of a separate bomb threat last month. And, you know, the Trump administration, including ICE Director Todd Lyons, have said there have been a more than 1,000% increase in attacks on ICE officers lately. This is what they use as a justification for agents using face coverings when conducting operations. But we haven't seen the data to confirm that spike. Still, President Trump also wrote a lengthy social media post tying anti-ICE attacks to, quote, deranged radical leftists, writing that ICE agents are facing an unprecedented increase in attacks and calling on Democrats to stop anti-ICE rhetoric. Democratic leaders say they reject violent rhetoric and feel and stand with the immigrant victims.
That is NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran in Dallas. Thank you so much, Sergio.
You're welcome.
In western Pennsylvania, steel plants are big employers and big polluters. This summer, the Trump administration paused regulations that would have forced the steel industry to curb air pollution. Reed Frazier of the public radio show The Allegheny Front reports on how that move will affect people living nearby.
For years, Dave and Cindy Meckel lived in the town of Glassport, Pennsylvania. They recently moved to a new house 30 miles away. Standing in his new backyard, Dave Meckel explains why they moved.
You can take a deep breath and you can smell trees. You take a deep breath in Glassport and you smell hydrogen sulfide, you smell sulfur dioxide.
That's because their old home was a mile and a half from a U.S. steel plant. That plant, in the town of Clairton, produces coke, a form of coal used in steel making. The plant is the area's largest single source of air pollution, a fact Cindy Meckel says was unavoidable.
Every day, we would have to go out and wipe off the tablecloth, and every day, the paper towel or the cloth was black.
A few years ago, as part of a public health initiative, the Meckels put up a monitor in their backyard for benzene, a known carcinogen. Their house recorded the highest levels in the neighborhood, similar to levels seen at some industrial plants. Cindy Meckel says the couple knew it was time to leave after three of their dogs died of cancer.
We just said, it's just a matter of time until it's us next, you know, that get diagnosed.
Last year, under former President Joe Biden, the Environmental Protection Agency issued new rules. For the first time, coke plants, like Clairton, would have been required to monitor for benzene emissions. But in July, the Trump administration paused those rules, saying it wasn't feasible for the industry to comply.
This is definitely a bad move for the people in the Mon Valley.
Deborah Gentile is a Pittsburgh area doctor who studied impacts from air pollution at U.S. steel plants in the Monongahela or Mon River Valley. She found almost a quarter of the kids living near U.S. steel plants had asthma.
And that's double to triple what you should be seeing.
The Biden-era rules would have required the Clairton plant to limit pollution linked to asthma. And if benzene emissions were found to exceed federal thresholds, it would have had to come up with a plan to cut them. U.S. Steel says the rules would have imposed exorbitant costs and impacted American jobs without bringing much environmental benefit.
Is there a way to clean it up? Yes.
Gordon Johnson is head of GLJ Research, which follows the steel industry. He says cleaning the industry up would probably require companies like U.S. Steel to switch away from the traditional use of coal to modern techniques that use electricity, natural gas, or hydrogen, and that would be expensive. Johnson says steel companies try to keep plants going as long as they can.
They're not just going to start nilly-willy shutting down plants. They'll patch it up, and they'll continue pushing steel out of the plant.
Local officials say they can't afford layoffs or losing the plant, which employs about 1,000 people. Rich Latanzi is Clairton's mayor.
You know, with the city of Clairton, it's about 30% of our tax base. Without that mill, I don't think the city can run.
Latanzi himself retired from U.S. Steel in 2021. He argues air quality has improved, and he supports the Trump administration's pause on the new rules.
We at least got a window of four years right now, if not longer, you know, that we can make some things happen. So I think big business is going to prosper. I think, you know, our economy is going to get better.
At their new house, the Meckels are skeptical. They both voted for Donald Trump, but they disagree with his administration's move to pause the new rules on air pollution.
We can have both. You can breathe clean air, and U.S. Steel can make money.
The Meckels have listed their old house in Glassport near the U.S. steel plant, but it hasn't sold yet. For NPR News, I'm Reed Frazier in Pittsburgh.
You've probably heard that it's getting hotter outside. Last year was the hottest on record globally, topping a record that was set the year before. But some of the places we go for refuge from the heat are getting hotter as well. NPR's Nate Rott reports that two studies this week show how U.S. rivers and streams are changing and how that's affecting fish.
Here's a fun fact about the U.S.
The lower 48 in the U.S. has some of like the highest fish diversity almost anywhere in the world outside the tropics.
Brian Gallagher is a researcher at Whitman College.
So for a temperate region, we have remarkable fish biodiversity.
That is a remarkable number of fish species living in our rivers and streams, from small, colorful darters to massive toothy pike. Gallagher was part of a team at the Environmental Protection Agency that wanted to know how that vast array of fish is changing. So they looked at nearly 400 different species across the country over a 27-year period, searching for trends.
And what we found is that it just differs a lot regionally.
In places where rivers and streams are warm,
those are either in like the middle of the country or more towards the southeastern or Gulf coasts.
They looked at the number of individual fish, abundance in science speak, and the types of different fish, which they call richness. Both had increased, and those fish were generally smaller.
And in cold streams, we see the exact opposite, where abundance and richness are going down.
And those fewer fish are generally larger. Those cold rivers and streams are mostly in the West, at higher elevations, the kinds of places people seek out for fishing. The new study published in the journal Nature found that the number of fish in cold water rivers and streams has dropped by more than 50%. Gallagher says that's in part because of non-native species, many of which have been introduced by people.
Those streams are also areas that had basically like the most rapid increases in air temperature during that same time.
Hotter air, a direct result of human activities that are warming the climate, means hotter water, which is what the second study by researchers at Penn State University found as well.
So I'm Li, first name and last name. In English, they're the same. You spell the same. In Chinese, they're actually different.
Li, a professor of ecological and civil engineering, co-authored a study published in the journal PNAS that looked at 40 years of data and found water heat waves, days when water temperatures are abnormally high, are now lasting nearly twice as long as air heat waves.
Meaning this kind of days are happening every year more, which would mean it would have big impact on the aquatic systems.
Authors of both studies say fish are an important source of food, income, and tradition for many Americans, so they need to be protected. Nate Rott, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18. You're listening to All Things Considered on KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a few moments, our daily dose of phenology, John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date. Support for KAXC comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, September 24th, 2007, I come out of the woods and find two deer ticks stuck to my body. I have a reaction to deer ticks almost immediately after they bite me. They begin to itch. And so it's seldom that they're on me long enough to transmit any of the diseases that they might carry. But this is not true for everybody. And if you are one of those people for whom deer ticks present a less obvious problem, then you need to continue to check yourselves daily if you've been out in the woods, because the deer ticks, unlike the wood ticks, remain active throughout the entire year. Any time that the average temperature during the day creeps above 40 degrees, it is possible for you to find deer ticks. I have reports from many, many listeners that there are deer ticks out in almost every month of the year. Perhaps December and January, fewer or none. But the rest of the months, be on the alert for deer ticks.
PR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Blaise Pascal was a mathematician, a scientist, a philosopher, a Christian writer, and the son of a tax collector in 17th century France. The family business involved a lot of tedious arithmetic, so Blaise Pascal came up with a machine, a wooden box with a series of dials connected to cogs and levers to help his dad with some of that adding and subtracting. He invented, basically, a calculator, and he was 19 years old. Fast forward a few centuries, and one of the few such machines we have left is expected to fetch over $2, maybe over $3 million when it's auctioned at Christie's in November. Well, for more, we have reached out to Eugenia Chang, a mathematician and author and scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so these devices were called Pascalines, I understand, and they don't resemble the calculators that, like, you and I had in school as kids. How would you describe what these machines look like and how they worked?
I would say that they are like bicycles compared with our calculators. Because one of the things I love about bicycles is you can look at them and kind of see them working.
Yeah.
And they involve things going round. And that's what this thing does. It's also a bit like an abacus. It has beads on rails.
Right.
And you have to move them yourself one by one. And every time you have finished moving all the beads on one rail, you have to do a carryover. Well, this machine does that for you using cogs and wheels. And I love the idea that Pascal, at the age of 19, was just bored of doing the arithmetic for his dad at work.
Yeah.
And so he said, I don't want to do this anymore, just like any teenager would and should, and went, I'm going to make a machine instead that will do it for me.
I mean, I love the irony of this, that a like math prodigy as a kid designs a machine that lets him circumvent the arithmetic.
And there's a really important story in there, which is that arithmetic is not math. And Pascal was a prodigy at mathematics, and he was proving things and doing things he thought, I think, were much more fun than this boring arithmetic
right.
for his dad's tax work. And so he figured out how to use basically the technology of clocks and watches with the cogs going round to automate it.
Cool. Okay, so to do this baby stuff, this arithmetic, what kinds of calculations basically could a Pascaline actually perform?
Very basic ones, as I understand it. So you can add up because you turn the dials to add numbers together. And then you can do multiplication because you turn the dials repeatedly. And there's a kind of sneaky way that you can use a little bit of theory to do subtraction as well. And that was about it. But that was already a really big deal for the epic quantities of arithmetic involved in doing tax calculations.
Okay, well, I want to read you the press release from Christie's because I'm so curious what you think. It says, quote, that the Pascaline is the first attempt in history to substitute the human mind with a machine. Its invention marks a breakthrough, a quantum leap. Okay, is that an overstatement or do you actually think that's a fair way to represent what the Pascaline was?
Well, it's definitely a piece of marketing, isn't it? But to say that it's trying to replace the human mind, I do think is a little bit of an overstatement. I think Pascal was trying to get a machine to do something that he didn't want to have to do himself so that he could use his mind to do something more interesting that he wanted more time to do. And I think that's generally what we are trying to get technology and indeed AI to do. We're not trying to replace human minds entirely, at least I'm not, but I love the idea of getting it to do the boring parts so that I can then go on to do the things that are more interesting. Yeah. And as for a quantum leap, well, it was a leap and it was definitely an important first step towards modern computers. And that was such a long time ago that it's hard to say whether it was a direct link to modern computers, but you can trace an intellectual journey straight from there to the computers we have now.
Okay, well, I just want to remind everyone that Pascal was just 19 years old when he invented the Pascaline. So I am curious, given the whole arc of his life, how does the invention of the Pascaline fit into the rest of his contributions in math and science, you think?
Well, let's remember, not only was he only 19, but it was also 1642, which was quite a long time ago. And in those days, there was just less known at the time. So it was easier for people to become experts in many things. He also worked in philosophy. There was some fluid dynamics. And I think that his contemporaries considered the Pascaline to be his greatest invention. I don't know if he would have considered this his greatest invention because he wanted to get on to do more interesting and more important things and not get stuck doing arithmetic all the time. So anyone who doesn't like doing arithmetic, I would say take heart in that.
That was Eugenia Chang, scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you for having me.
In baseball, disagreeing with an umpire's call is just about as old as the sport itself. Now, players will be able to do something about it. Starting next season, Major League Baseball will introduce a challenge system for balls and strikes. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
Let me explain first how this system is going to work.
0-2 on Machado.
This is this year's All-Star game, where they tried it out. It's the bottom of the first inning. The Cy Young favorite, Tarek Skubal, is on the mound, mic'd up, talking to the Fox broadcast crew. Batter Manny Machado is at the plate, down on an 0-2 count. Skubal throws a fastball near the bottom of the zone.
Ball down!
Oh, what do you think?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The umpire calls it a ball. Catcher Cal Raleigh disagrees and taps his helmet, the signal to trigger a review. On the screen, a computerized replay shows that, in fact, the pitch was a strike. Batter's out. Big ol' smile crosses Skubal's face.
Hey,
you take him any way you can get him, boys.
MLB has tested this system out for a while in the minor leagues. Most major leaguers experienced it for the first time during spring training this year.
I thought the umpires were really locked in spring training. Hitters were really locked in during spring training. I thought it was great.
This is Rob Thompson, the manager of the Philadelphia Phillies. Each team will start every game with two challenges. If a player gets his challenge wrong, the team loses one. But if the player gets it right, the team gets to keep that challenge and can use it again.
I love it. And I loved it in spring training. And I think it keeps everybody accountable. It keeps everybody on their toes.
The only players who can call for a challenge will be the pitcher, catcher, or batter. And they have to do it right away without a sign from the dugout. In spring training this year, there were some really silly challenges. Guys just trying it, seeing what it's like, having a laugh. But come next season, when it's rolled out in games that count, that'll all have to sharpen up, says Aaron Boone, the manager of the New York Yankees.
What are the rules in a particular inning, in a particular bat, particular counts, and things like that? Making sure you are as buttoned up as you can be so you're in a position to, you know, overturn the most impactful calls of the game in a given night.
In spring training, there were about four challenges a game. That added about a minute on average to the duration. Players got the calls overturned a little more than half the time. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a few moments, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo. Serving the area since 1916, more at atchisontire.com. And we thank the Bush Foundation, accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship now through noon on October 7th. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders in their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their leadership plan. Visit bushfoundation.org. Mostly clear tonight, lows near 55, and tomorrow sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s. Overnight lows tomorrow in the upper 40s, and for Friday, sunny, highs 70 to 75.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Tuesday, we reported about how people in tribal communities say they're getting approached by predatory representation and solicitation in the wake of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, being revived by Congress this summer. That story from KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio continues.
With the tribal fair season in full swing, solicitors are even targeting elders there, like 64-year-old Maggie Billyman in rural western New Mexico.
It's overwhelming. Who do you trust? Who do you go to?
At her home in northeastern Arizona, she says many Navajos, like herself, struggle with all sorts of cancers. Billyman lives with COPD and chronic renal failure or kidney disease. The daughter of a late uranium miner and Navajo code talker, Billyman recalls being asked to sign up with a national home health care company at the Eastern Navajo Fair in Crown Point. But that happened in July, a month before the DOJ reopened the free process.
And she looked at me real surprised, and she goes, "We can get your record for you if you lie, pull it out." And I said, "Oh my God," I got up out of the chair.
That fair booth was run by UEW, or United Energy Workers Healthcare, which paid $9 million in 2023 to settle allegations of submitting false claims to the U.S. Department of Labor. Several requests from KJZZ to UEW went unanswered. They've been named among companies and attorneys in the West on a growing watch list curated by a working group led by the nonprofit Union of Concerned Scientists. Their advocacy has led New Mexico's attorney general to warn consumers to watch out for fraud. Cancer survivor Tina Cordova is sounding the alarm, too.
It's pervasive. The scale is unprecedented.
Co-founder of the nonprofit Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, she and others cite as an example downwinders.com, a web domain trademarked by the Florida Incorporated National Cancer Benefits Center, which also owns another company called Atomic Veterans.
They've made people believe that they're working with us.
National Cancer Benefits Center CEO Kirk Gladwin denies the allegations, stressing his company is part of the solution.
We do not solicit. We do not knock on doors. We do not call anybody ever. And we never have unless those people ask us for information. Don't let anybody tell you that, because that's bullshit. And I hate to say that, but that I'll draw the line. That makes me angry, because that's not us.
Those affected can still find free assistance from a handful of federally funded health clinics through RECEP, the Radiation Exposure Screening and Education Program.
The scams were new to me.
Candace Lewis is Dene and the RECEP patient navigator at North Country Healthcare in Flagstaff. It's one of only two such clinics in Arizona, and she's getting calls from all over.
I actually got off the phone earlier today with someone who was from New Mexico, and he shared a little bit of what he was going through. It was a hard call. They didn't even state their name.
That's supposed to be her job, so it upsets her.
Lawyers have more power and more pull than me. And it has been a little overwhelming at times, but I'm just like, bear with me. Just be patient with us.
Because if someone lawyers up, Lewis says her clinic can no longer help them with filing a RECA claim before the end of 2027. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and the state of Wisconsin recently celebrated new dual language road signs. The new signs identify the tribe's boundaries and two river crossings in Ojibwe, Mohan, and English. The Bad River Band is the eighth of 12 tribes in the state to collaborate on such highway signs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976. From opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance. With offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Support by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. More at aarp.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Ukraine's president had an unusual pitch at the United Nations General Assembly today. He said the UN has failed to resolve Russia's war against his country. So, Volodymyr Zelensky says, Ukraine has had to rely on its friends and its own weapons. And he said Ukrainian drones have been so successful against Russia that he's ready to start exporting them to like-minded nations, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Speaking to the General Assembly for the fourth time as a wartime president, Volodymyr Zelensky says he's learned one big lesson about the world body.
Today, no one but ourselves can guarantee security. Only strong alliances, only strong partners, and only our own weapons.
He told the UN General Assembly that Russia's war has sparked an arms race, and he touted the drones Ukraine has been building to defend itself from Russia's stockpile of missiles and Iranian-made drones.
Ukraine doesn't have the big, fat missiles dictators love to show off in parades, but we do have drones that can fly up to 2,000-3,000 kilometers. We had no choice but to build them to protect our right to life.
Zelensky spoke a lot about Ukrainian drones, telling countries around the world that they should do business with Ukraine rather than Russia.
We are ready to make our modern weapons become your modern security, your modern weapon. And we have decided to open up arms exports. And these are powerful systems tested in a real war when every international institution failed.
The sales pitch seemed to have worked on President Trump, who met with Zelensky on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Trump now seems to think that Ukraine can retake territory now occupied by Russia. And he had this to say at one of his many photo ops on Tuesday.
It's been a terrible war. It should have ended. And Russia should have stopped it. But they've been 3.5 years and they've gotten not so far. So we'll see what happens. But the other side can fight, too. And they've proven that. Maybe it could be that Russia's a paper tiger.
Trump said he thought it would be easy to end the war because of his close relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
But unfortunately, that relationship didn't mean anything, unfortunately.
Ever since he hosted Putin in Alaska last month, the Russians have stepped up their strikes on Ukrainian cities and towns and even violated NATO airspace with drones and fighter jets. European diplomats at the UN have been pressing Trump to put more pressure on Putin. Russian diplomats have called the Europeans paranoid Russophobes. Putin did not come to the UN, so there are few expectations of any real negotiations. Secretary of State Marco Rubio did meet his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, though they did not speak to reporters. Zelensky's pitch was mostly about rallying the world to turn against Russia.
Whether you help peace or continue trading with Russia and helping Russia to fund this war, it depends on you.
And he urged countries not to stay silent. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the United Nations.
California's dramatic Pacific coastline is arguably the state's most valuable asset. But erosion and rising sea levels are causing that coastline to crumble ever more rapidly into the ocean. One effort to slow down that process starts with dinner scraps. Jill Replegal from member station LAist has this story.
At the Blue Water Grill in Newport Beach, a worker lugs a large plastic storage bin out of the kitchen and into the back of Keisha Kenny's minivan. We take a peek inside the bin. It's full of oyster shells. This pickup is the first phase of a project led by Kenny's group, Orange County Coast Keeper. The goal is to use the shells to restore the once abundant oyster beds along the coast, and by doing that, protect the shoreline from erosion and rising seas. They've been doing it since 2024.
You can see there's like a little bit of food scraps in here, which is fine because they sit out in a field and they have little animals that will come and like kind of pick off the food scraps.
We head inland to a hot, sunny patch of land. Here, Kenny weighs each restaurant's contribution and spreads the shells out to cure in the sun, to rid them of pathogens and any leftover horseradish and Tabasco sauce. Once cured, the shells will go to someone like Craig Schopner.
Let's go over here.
Schopner is one of about 80 residents in Huntington Harbor, just up the coast, who's become a kind of oyster nanny. Some of those discarded restaurant shells will hopefully attract oyster larvae floating through the water.
So, yeah.
Schopner pulls up a wire strung with about a dozen oyster shells and points out a small dark circle on the inside of one of them.
So you can see, like, right there, there's a spot. There might have been an oyster there at one time, but maybe a predator came and ate it or something like that.
His shell strings don't seem to be particularly attractive to any baby oysters this year, but that's okay, he says.
Part of the project is to figure out where we can harvest oysters, so I'm contributing to the data, right?
Schopner's oysters, if he gets any, are not for eating. They're going to be put to work. See, oysters do a lot to keep the marine environment and the shoreline healthy. When oyster larvae settle on shells, they start to secrete their own shells, effectively gluing the shells together to form oyster beds. If you transplant them to areas vulnerable to erosion, it can help prevent the coastline from washing out to sea. Danielle Zacherl is a biology professor at California State University, Fullerton.
They also encourage sedimentation by generating eddies, the shells like popping up into the water column, slow the water velocity and allow sediment to filter down. That's really important for coastal habitats right now, especially in the face of climate change.
And oysters remove excess nutrients from the water that cause harmful algal blooms. In fact, a single adult oyster can filter up to 50 gallons a day. They also improve water quality for eelgrass, which sequesters carbon, provides habitat for ocean critters, and also helps prevent erosion. Zacherl and the organization Coast Keeper plan to use the shells hanging off Schopner and his neighbor's docks, seeded with baby oysters, to create what are called living shorelines in several places along the Southern California coast. They only harvested 10 last year, but they have a lot more people participating this year. And even the shells without oysters will attract baby oysters in the wild once transplanted and create habitat that helps stabilize the shoreline.
Think about this natural product that's getting sent to landfills that really could be doing so much more good.
Living shorelines are becoming popular across the country. They're seen as more cost-efficient and ecologically friendly compared to what's known as hard armoring. Think seawalls and riprap. Schopner and his fellow oyster nannies will soon have to give up their slimy charges. It's hard for some of them to let go, but just a little bit easier, knowing those oysters will be helping clean the water and reestablish a resilient California coast. For NPR News, I'm Jill Replegal in Orange County.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 4:44. In a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8 p.m. More information at timberlakelodgehotel.com. And a message from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988 with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KAXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. You can call Sarah for more details, 218-326-1234.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, some Minnesota lawmakers want tougher penalties for suspects who run from police. Then, we take a look at how to practice personal safety in the digital world. And an effort in Grand Marais to get people to connect without technology. I'm Gracie J. A high-speed chase in Minneapolis that killed two women and injured a young child has lawmakers calling for tougher penalties for those who run from police. Senator Julia Coleman, a Republican from Waconia, which is about 30 minutes west of the metro, posted on social media that ever since her own family was put at risk by a suspect fleeing police, she has been working on bills to address the issue. Coleman's post goes on to say that those who put others' lives in danger while fleeing police should be punished appropriately. Some members of the DFL are saying they support Coleman's efforts. Next, in the wake of cyber attacks like the one in St. Paul earlier this summer, concerns about digital security are growing across Minnesota. Reporter Faya Adam has some tips on how you can stay safe online.
When hackers locked down St. Paul systems in a July ransomware attack, city employees had to change all their passwords. Cybercrime can feel distant until it hits your own inbox. With scams like fake Department of Motor Vehicles or DMV texts on the rise, knowing how to protect yourself online has never been more important.
It is a bit of a myth that only older adults don't have the digital skills. We have 18 different assessments, and I have yet to meet anyone who's passed all 18 with 100%, from teenagers up through people in their 80s.
Teresa Sladek is the Strategic Partnerships and North Star Business Development Manager at Literacy Minnesota. The nonprofit organization provides digital literacy training for adults.
I think people are also just scared in general, at any age, are scared that they might break something, they might mess something up. And a lot of people, I think they're just afraid that they themselves won't be able to understand it.
Phishing is a scam where criminals pretend to be a trusted source to trick someone into giving out their personal information. Learning how to identify common phishing methods, such as fake texts from the DMV or suspicious emails from the bank, can keep people's information safe.
The landscape changes so much, and especially the scamming landscape. It's better to understand that what you're taught can be their transferable skills. And to, for let's say phishing scams, to recognize, rather than an individual scam, kind of patterns to look for to suggest that something might be dangerous.
What AI helps the criminals do is, first of all, sort of their market research. So they can use AI software to sort of scour the internet and find out information about their target, the person that they want to scam. It allows them to generate content, so it will help them figure out the perfect scam to target the kind of person that they're trying to steal money from.
Jay Hoppala is the Associate State Director of Community Engagement for AARP Minnesota. He is referring to the use of artificial intelligence for online scams.
AARP runs a program called the Fraud Watch Network, and part of that is that people call us and report nationwide from all across the country. They call and report the scams that they see.
Here are a few more tips to keep your information safe. If you get a text claiming to be from the DMV or your bank asking for your information, don't engage. It is a common phishing scam. If an email looks suspicious, make sure the email actually matches the sender's. Don't click on links in emails or texts from people you don't know. Use unique, strong passwords. If one gets exposed in a data breach, the rest of your accounts are safe. For North Star Stories, I'm Faya Adam.
are listening to North Star Stories. A unique project in Grand Marais is encouraging people to put down their phones and break out the pen and paper. The Literacy Deck claims to be the only free public letter writing park in the world. Now, with two locations in Grand Marais, the Literacy Deck offers a space, stationery, pens and markers, stamps, and they'll even mail your letters for you, all for free. Organizers say letters help to reduce loneliness and isolation. The Literacy Deck is open through October 20th.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Art is always personal. Good art, at least, is always personal. But sometimes art can be deeply, maybe even painfully personal. Revealing, vulnerable, emotionally raw. That is certainly the case for singer and fiddle player Amanda Shires and her new album, Nobody's Girl. In a series of blunt and honest songs, Shires processes her divorce from fellow Nashville star Jason Isbell. The two had long collaborated on their music and become an intertwined force for many music fans. And now Shires is figuring out how to reset things. Amanda Shires, welcome back to All Things Considered.
I am so happy that you'd have me.
We are really happy to have you. And let me just start with a pretty straightforward question. What made you want to make this album? Was it more to help you process things and think about things? Or was it more to tell other people your point of view on things, or a little bit of both?
It was definitely selfishly to help me process things. I just wanted to, I don't know, I just had to get it out there, have a place for the experience to live. And then through the process, I kind of continued to write and to find beauty in the kind of aftermath and everything.
Yeah.
And discovering that even though I'm not somebody's wife anymore, I'm still, now what I am is I'm a mother, I'm a painter, I'm a songwriter. And after the aftermath, you know, you can find freedom. And then now I realize I don't belong to anybody but myself, and I'm not less because of what I lost, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of things were different. Obviously, big changes in your life. I know you made a lot of this album in L.A., and that was different. How was the songwriting process different than previous ones? Like, what to you was different about this? How did it feel?
Oh, I selfishly used music on this one. It's really what got me through that whole thing. I had to explain it all to myself somehow. And there's a lot of songs that didn't make it on there. And the ones that did, I'm pretty proud of. And even the end, the last song I wrote for it was Away It Goes. Like that discovery of how to sum up the collection as a whole, I guess. And also in that last verse where it goes into the hopeful, hopeful things again. Song that I didn't put on there called Good Luck on Your Way Out. And I was, after I did that, I was just like, that's not actually how I feel. I really truly feel that everybody gets to be happy, and that while it's true that love changes course and marriages end, I guess being a grown-up now, or having been, I don't know if I've ever been, actually, now that I'm 43, I have enough experience to, and you know, enough insight into my own self to know that I don't truly feel those ways. I know that it's a thing that'll pass.
Sometimes it's hard to act like a grown-up, though. It feels better, at least in the moment, to kind of embrace that bitter rage, you know, in one way or the other.
I mean, you have to do that. And, you know, I didn't treat myself super well in the process of getting through this. And I tried some weird things out, you know. Like, I tried out jujitsu, and then I tried out other things, like probably, you know, overconsumption of some alcohols. And then I discovered backgammon and weightlifting, and that was the place where I started putting my frustration, and then backgammon really showed me it's not about the roles, it's about what you do with them.
Weightlifting and backgammon are two really different outlets. That's interesting.
Yeah, one of them is like a war, and the other one's just like for sheer expulsion of anger.
Yeah. Can I ask you just a couple more questions about kind of the real honest turn of this album? Because I'm sure, as you imagine, that that's what's getting the most attention. I just want to talk about one specific song, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
The song Details, you sing, gonna have to put the house up for sale. He scared me then, he still scares me now. Never will hear me out. The thing he justifies it, using me and cashing in on our marriage.
He scared me then, and he still scares me now. Never will hear me out. The thing is, he justifies it, using me and cashing in on our marriage. He erases the details.
Can you talk to me about the songwriting process of just being so direct? How did you know the level of detail and the level of bluntness was right in the end? How did you kind of get to that point of like, this is the right compromise in terms of what I'm trying to do as a musician, what I'm trying to do to kind of process things myself?
There's two things I want to say about that. You have to have like, you can't just omit the uncomfortable things. To me, it doesn't feel like it would be as real of a record or a... Yeah, because I kind of have to have all the feelings to paint the picture.
No matter how clear I keep the memories, you rewrite them so you can sleep.
That song's not one I'm going to play live ever. It's just that song I had to write, and I know that it'll probably be useful for other people. I had to have a place where I could put my experience and keep it somewhere. So
yeah,
it's really easy for revisionist history to happen, and it's easy to, you know, for myself to, hell, I do it sometimes, try to rewrite my daily humiliations and pretend like I didn't fall flat on my ass. But it's kind of hard to explain, but I'm doing my best.
You were talking before about, and I'm not going to play that song live. Like, what was your favorite song from this album that you are excited to play, and why?
I like to play Peace of Mind a whole lot. It's rock and roll, and it's a little bit different for me for what I've done, and I also see ways that I could, you know, have some more rock and roll songs in my future. But I feel like to me, my finest writing on the record, which isn't a song that I would play every night, it'd have to be in, you know, specific rooms probably. It's called Living.
Just existing can be hard. Maybe living is an art.
There's a line in there about maybe living is an art, because I think it is true. There's an art to it. And you want to do it right. That's true. You got one life. Live it.
I'm singer, songwriter, and fiddle player Amanda Shires. Her new album, Nobody's Girl, is out September 26th. Amanda, after so many years of listening to it, it was really nice to talk to you. Thanks for coming by.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Perfect conditions don't fix it.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxe.org. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and at 7 tonight, Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Mostly clear tonight with lows near 55 and sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 70s, with our lows tomorrow night in the upper 40s, and looking ahead to Friday, sunny, highs in